It's July 4th, 1987. The community of Athens, Wisconsin is out to enjoy the holiday, but not everyone is celebrating. Tonight, four members of the Coons family will be murdered, and one will be missing.
Within hours, we realized it had been an entire family that had been wiped out. That's very, very weird, and that story just went from weird to weirder.
The story spins out of control when one of the victims is a suspected drug dealer.
Bottom line is there's four people dead, one person missing, and at least on our end, a whole lot of questions.
People don't know if this is a drug deal gone wrong, a robbery turned bad, or Helen Coons did it all herself. But in a close community like Athens, somebody knows something. As one travels the WI-97 on their way from Medford down to Wausau, you stumble upon Athens, Wisconsin. It's the kind of place where the American dream is born. Visitors might stop by a local cafe for a coffee with friends, or maybe one's in town for their 116-year-old fair to hit up the Midway that takes place in August. Known for being a quiet town, perfect for raising a family and a killer ball team, there's an event that mars the pristine streets. Over 30 years ago, just 6 miles west of town, a massacre changed the community and Marathon County forever.
I had been working for the paper about 6 months when the Coons murders occurred. The Coonses originally were from Manitowoc, and when they arrived in Marathon County, they couldn't have picked a worse time. The county, which had once been part of the lumber industry in Wisconsin, the lumber from Marathon County built Chicago, but all those trees were gone, and all that was left were the stumps. Cutover, which Marathon County is the center of, was considered the poorest area in the United States.
The Coons family settles in Marathon County in early 1906. They live a secluded life on their 108-acre farm, 6 miles west of Athens. After Ignatz and Ann Coons pass away, they leave the family farm to their son, Clarence, who builds the current home on the property.
Athens is a smaller community and primarily agriculture, dairy farms.
You've heard the saying, America's Dairyland. We take pride in that. And generally, if we're doing a story out there in the late 1980s, it's either agriculture related or maybe there's a highway expansion, something like that. A homicide case like this is just the last thing you expect.
By the summer of 1987, siblings Irene, Marie, Clarence, and Helen Coons all live on the farm with Helen's two sons, 30-year-old Randy and 55-year-old Kenneth, who is painfully shy. All but Kenneth live in the dilapidated main house with just a wood stove for heat and no running water. It seems for the Coons family, time had stood still. Of the six people living on the property, only Kenneth, known as Kenny, has an employment record. He spends his days at a local cheese factory, while the rest of the family lives off Social Security. Known as local hoarders, the Coons farm is a cornucopia of old implements and vehicles, which they've bought and sold. Due to the secluded lifestyle inherited from their parents, most of the Coons family is exceptionally private and reclusive. Helen and Randy were always seen together. Randy is Helen's chauffeur, constantly driving her to wherever she needs to go. He often waits in the car as she does her errands, even when she has her weekly Sunday breakfast in town. Helen Coons is an enigma for most of the community. She's quiet and polite. Like most of her family, she still dresses as though it's 1930, as if time moved everywhere except on their farm. In a way, the Coonses are set apart from the community. They have so little interaction with people in the town of Athens that they are seen as oddities. But the 4th of July in an area like Athens is an important event. It's a time when everyone who lives there comes together. Like many families on Independence Day, this Saturday is a typical family day for the Coonses. Enjoying time together, they have a picnic in the yard to celebrate. Helen and Randy are in Athens, the town miles from their home. Taking in the celebrations as they ring in the 4th of July. Leaving around 10:30 p.m. together after the fireworks. Kenny Coons is out to have a good time himself. He goes to the cheese factory where he works to clean up his truck and have some drinks. At some point that night, Kenny buys fireworks, a common occurrence on the 4th of July. Kenny has a lot of cash on him, but where does it come from? Some believe he's selling drugs for his younger brother, Randy, who a witness says is a drug dealer in the area.
The hidden secret with rural Wisconsin is that drug use is spreading from the major communities, from the major cities. People are desperate to support their drug habit, and they will resort to any means necessary. But if that means petty crime, then so be it. And that's a struggle for small communities. They don't know how to deal with it.
Randy Coons's reclusive nature and lack of attention seeking make him a perfect candidate to be a potential small-time dealer in the area. Is it reasonable that Randy would have Kenny involved? As the only one in the family with a regular job, he would have access to more customers. It's 10:50 at night, and Kenny is at the cheese factory. Little does he know what's about to happen back at the family farm. Having left around 10:30 p.m. from the fireworks display, Helen and Randy arrive at home. At some time between 10:30 and 11 p.m., Irene dozes while watching TV in the living room. Clarence is asleep in the bed that's in the room, having gone down for the night at 8 p.m. But someone has sinister plans for the Coons family. What happened at the Coons farm that hot July night? When Kenny gets back to the farmyard around 5 a.m., he does his best to be quiet. He knows it's early. He slept in his car last night and doesn't want to wake anyone up now that he's back home.
When Kenny came home, two things that he found strange was that Randy's car wasn't in the front of the house and that the radio was on at, you know, like 6 in the morning, loud.
He realizes something's off. He goes over to the house to see what's going on.
That's when he saw Marie slumped on the steps.
His Aunt Marie lays dead on the steps. Where is everyone else? Candy enters the home to find his brother, Randy, dead in the kitchen. As he looks around, the terrifying events are revealed. His uncle Clarence is dead too. The gravity of the situation starts to take hold. His attention then turns to his mother, Helen, who is missing. Where is she? Is she in the house? Is she outside? But Helen is nowhere to be seen. Athens, Wisconsin. Population, 1105. Known for its 116-year-old town fair and being a quiet town perfect for raising a family, its surrounding agriculture sprawls out across the countryside. In a small area known as Bern, just 6 miles from Athens, lies the Kunz family farm. Here, the fields turn to dense forest cover. It's in this very place that a horrendous crime is committed. Kenny Kunz has just made a startling discovery. 4 members of his family are dead, and his 70-year-old mother, Helen, is missing. It's the morning of July 5th, 1987, and Marathon County Coroner John Larson has arrived at the scene to find Kenny Kunz standing grimly outside the residence. Nothing could prepare him for what he would discover inside.
I was the Marathon County coroner at the time of the Kunz case. This would have been a very unusual occurrence. I don't know that there had been any homicides or any kind of major crime in Athens for many years. When I arrived on scene and I went to the house, just inside that back porch door was the body of Marie Kunz. She had apparent gunshot wound.
As a former medical examiner investigator, if I was to come across a scene that had multiple victims and I was advised of that, that would be the first red flag, because that usually is something that's usually always of a suspicious nature. So I would automatically ask the police department that I am working with to secure that scene, so that way we preserve all of the evidence that is within that scene. No one contaminates it, so that we can get a very clear picture after going through with the forensic identification team to make a determination of what actually has occurred at the scene.
Randy's body shows signs of a struggle, and the door shows no sign of a forced entry. This leads authorities to think that the perpetrator is known to the Kunzes, or they were at least let in willingly.
Randy Kunz is lying in the kitchen, and we were concerned with Randy because he had a wound close to the middle of his forehead that was kind of a somewhat gaping wound, and we weren't sure initially if that was a wound from some type of a sharp instrument, possibly a hatchet. He had some blunt force trauma to his head. So not only was he shot, but he was struck with an instrument.
Evidence, that's where you have that wording called chain of custody. The police department makes sure that the only one that is going to take any items out of that scene is the forensic identification unit, and they move that evidence from the scene to then their crime lab. We also do that with the body. We take that body to the morgue with police presence and lock them up, and again, we have all preservation of evidence until an autopsy is performed.
The wound on Randy's head actually turned out to be a graze or a gutter wound, where the bullet actually went through the skin. and just grazed it. And we were able to identify that that was actually a bullet wound at autopsy. One of the crime lab technicians, who is extremely knowledgeable about firearms, he had strong suspicions that this was a semi-automatic long gun. Clarence was lying on his right side, and Clarence had two gunshot wounds just below his right eye. There was a body identified, an elderly little woman, as Irene Coons. She was sitting in a cushioned chair. Her head was slumped forward.
Forensic evidence also shows that the family dies between 10:30 and 11 p.m. on July 4th. Right around that time, Helen and Randy would have been arriving home after leaving the fireworks display. Investigators wonder if this was just a robbery on the secluded farm that went wrong. But there is money seemingly everywhere. They find envelopes full of it. The total is $22,000 in cash, the equivalent of over $50,000 today. But where did it all come from? Is it from Randy's supposed drug dealing? If not robbery, what's the motive of this horrible crime? It doesn't take long for the investigators to discover some disturbing signs of the nature of the Coons household, the mess notwithstanding. Despite the veritable squalor of the Coons home, there is a new television and VCR. And next to that, there are dozens and dozens of pornographic videotapes out in the open in the family living room.
The bodies were each placed in a body bag. At that time, the sheriff's department, they had a pickup truck that had a cap or a topper on it. It's a little embarrassing now to think that we're transporting bodies in a pickup truck. It's not a great deal of dignity, but it's what we had, and those were the resources that we had at the time.
I was in the house, and you could hardly move through it. There was so much stuff. In the main room, the living room, Clarence slept with two of his sisters, Irene and Marie. And there was pornography everywhere. I mean, there were stacks of pornography everywhere.
Suspicion immediately falls on the only person readily available, Kenny Coons.
This is often referred to as a family annihilation, where one person in the family suffers a trauma at the hands of one or more of the persons that have been murdered. Given the state of the home and the disturbing evidence found within, it led investigators to believe initially that Kenny was a suspect.
The sheriff's department immediately eliminated Kenny as a suspect because when he ran to a neighbor's house and asked to call the police or the sheriffs, and the sheriffs came, he said, there are three people dead in the house and two people missing. But there are actually four people dead in the house. And if he had actually killed those people, he would have gotten the number right, at least.
Back at the Coons farm, more interesting evidence is discovered. For some reason, Randy's car is parked in the garden that Kenny has freshly tilled up. Something neighbors say they've never seen before. Several tire tracks are there. Most of the tracks are accounted for, but one set of tracks is a mystery. But the most pressing question remains. Where is Helen Coons? Is she still alive? What does she know about the murder of her family members? Athens, Wisconsin's motto is a friendly town that bands together. When news that Helen Coons has disappeared and the rest of the family has been murdered, they do just that. Community members mount a search of the 108-acre Coons farm. They search through the outbuildings and acres of heavily wooded land. As Helen's disappearance drags on, authorities expand their search. But still, they find nothing.
I know that there were a lot of searches done, searches of the area cornfields, searches of woods. They had volunteers, and it was very disconcerting that there was not a trace of Helen Coons. I mean, the community was just, they were shaken tremendously that there was a homicide in this very small town.
One of the weirdest parts of this case was that this woman, Helen Coons, 70 years old, had vanished. People started wearing these buttons that said, "Where's Helen?"
The incredibly private Coons family's personal information is now under a microscope. Investigators start to analyze Helen's movements. Could she be the perpetrator? Just a few weeks before the incident, Helen buys 22 caliber shells for what she says is to shoot blackbirds. But with the murder weapon also being a 22 caliber firearm, suspicion arises. Could Helen have motive to kill her family?
When Helen became pregnant with Kenny, she was 15. She had just turned 15. And she claimed that a bootlegger that lived across the road from the Coons farm in Marathon County had raped her. He was convicted of statutory rape. He went to prison for about 18 months, lost his farm, eventually died in a car accident. But the bootlegger said everyone knows that Helen and Clarence, her brother, are in a sexual relationship. The idea that Kenny was Helen's son through a relationship with her brother Clarence, one of the victims of the shooting, never disappeared. When the sheriff's department asked Kenny who the victims were, he said Clarence, his uncle, was also his father. And at first, the sheriff's thought he's just confused. He's just not following what's going on here. But he meant it. There were other reasons to suspect that Helen might have been angry. An Associated Press reporter was interviewing someone that ran the hardware store in Athens. And the person there said, how are you doing? She said, "I'm just so angry. You know, my family, all they do is watch pornography all day long. And I just want to kill them. It makes me so mad, I just want to kill them."
Though Kenny later denies saying anything about incest in the recorded police interview, the pornographic videotapes found at the home and Helen's own statement at the hardware store give investigators a feeling that something is amiss at the Coons residence. Have all the years of routine and squalor finally caused Helen to snap? Did she mean it when she said, "I just want to kill them"? Was it all too much? Is this issue with pornography the final straw? Did she just grab some money as quickly as she could, knowing Kenny was coming home soon and needed to get out of there? The police are desperate to find her, as she is the key to finding out what really happened. 4 members of the Coons family have been murdered, and 70-year-old Helen Coons is missing. Despite a massive search, authorities still don't know where Helen is. They broaden their investigation in hopes of getting more clues. Authorities have heard rumors about Randy's drug dealing. Could this have something to do with what happened?
As an investigator, it's a very humbling experience when you have a crime scene with very little evidence and everyone's looking at you, everyone's looking for answers. There's all kinds of pressure that's put upon you by the media and by the community. When you have no clues and you have no suspects, this is when the real hard police work begins. Because you know somewhere, someone has to know something.
Months go by and Helen is still missing. Recently, a young man has bought a car off the Coonses, Chris Jacobs III. Perhaps he knows something that could give the investigators a better understanding of the Kunz's world. Maybe he saw something or noticed someone else at their farm that could be a clue.
He was a young man, a farmer, from across the county line in Taylor County, rural Medford.
Chris Jacobs was arrested for stealing a car, and he had chopped the car and dumped the parts in a marsh not too far from his house. And he was just a troublemaker.
Police are hoping Chris can provide some insight into the Kunzes due to his dealings with them. But he can't offer any new information, so he's released. In addition to this, a neighbor gives a telling report that may provide investigators with the answers they need. When driving home on July 4th, 1987, local neighbor Alice goes down the road near the Kunz farm. She spots what appears to be a car waiting near the entrance of the Kunz farm, but is met with the glare of a spotlight. Curiously, the car follows her until she is well past the Kunz farm. But will her tale equate to an arrest? Without seeing who the driver is, what does this tell authorities? March 1988. Spring has just hit Wisconsin, and two boys are out to enjoy a little fishing. An ominous odor catches their senses, leading them to a haunting discovery.
Helen Kunz's remains were found after the search went underground in the spring of 1988. Now the final victim had been found, but what exactly did that mean?
We now have a fifth confirmed victim, but we may not be a whole lot closer to getting this case charged and into court.
Helen, her body was found out in the outside environment. So we have things such as Mother Nature with the hot sunshine and wind, and she was also in water. So many months later, it would have been very difficult to do a visual recognition of her body. As an investigator, the most important thing in terms of suspecting that that would have been Helen is to do a positive identification. We would be looking for things such as fingerprints for Helen. We would be looking for any sort of dental work.
With Helen discovered, investigators must double down on the evidence they have. After their initial interaction with Chris Jacobs, investigators decide to follow up. A search of his bedroom discovers some striking evidence.
The shell casings had interesting evidence because you have the firing pin mark, which is like a fingerprint of a weapon. On each and every spent shell casing, that's extremely identifiable, along with the breech marks. When that bullet is fired and it expands, the breech expands and stamps on the part of the base of the barrel, the breech, and it leaves absolutely identifiable marks.
The shell casings found in Chris's room are the same as the ones found at the Kunz's. As the search continues, police also discover a handheld spotlight in Chris Jacobs' car. Local neighbor Alice had said someone had shone a spotlight in her face that fateful night when she passed the Kunz farm.
The onus is on the prosecutor to compile enough evidence to present to the court to prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt. So when the prosecutor is deciding whether or not to initiate a prosecution on behalf of the federal government, there's two issues that they have to consider. The first is whether there's enough evidence to prove that case beyond a reasonable doubt, and the second is whether or not prosecuting that case best serves the interests of the public. And criminal trials can be very lengthy, so the prosecutor needs to make sure that they have all of the evidence that they think they need to prove the case prior to starting that trial.
The evidence is piling up against Chris Jacobs, but Chris maintains his innocence. The police feel like he's their man and press charges against him. Chris purchases a vehicle from the Kunzes. This we know. But prosecutors have a theory about what happens during the encounter. Prosecutors theorize that Chris has to go inside the Kunzes' home to get the bill of sale. While inside, Chris is shocked by the Kunzes' home and living arrangements. Chris notices money lying around. After getting the bill of sale, he hatches a plan to rob the Kunz family. Key defense witness, local man Wayne D. Weiler, gives investigators a statement saying that Chris Jacobs told him that he was planning to rob the Kunz family. Investigators contend that Chris and one or two other unnamed individuals sneak onto the Kunz family farm and brutally murder the Kunz family. The men gain entry to the house and demand the money that Chris saw. Something startles the men, and things go wrong. Did Randy try to defend his family from the assailants? A struggle ensues. Perhaps Chris doesn't expect the Kunzes to fight back, and Randy is the next to die. But something occurs that's unclear. What happens to Helen? What makes her so unique that Chris and the other assailants take her with them? Why is there so much money left at the house? Is the motive robbery? Investigators say that the tire tracks at the Kunz farm match Chris's car. Did Alice see them as she drives by? Autopsies show that Helen dies around the same time as the rest of her family. Her body is dumped 19 miles away in the Taylor County Muskeg. When Jacobs is arrested for stealing and stripping a car months earlier, he is found to have thrown car parts in the swamps around his farm. Helen is found in the same area. Despite the evidence against Chris Jacobs, his lawyer has another theory behind what really happened that night. The Kunz family is killed on their farm during what might be a botched robbery attempt. Investigators have gathered significant evidence that they believe implicates Chris Jacobs III. The defense must debunk these allegations if they hope to get Chris acquitted. Shell casings found in Chris Jacobs' room match the ones found at the Kunz farm. Or do they? A defense witness contests it's only a possible match. Besides, if Chris is going to rob the Kunzes, why is there still so much money there? Chris's lawyer is also doubtful that he can be linked to the case by such flimsy and circumstantial evidence. Like the tire tracks. It's established that Chris was at the Kunz's residence to buy a car. Of course his tracks are there. The defense theorizes that the murders result from a drug deal gone wrong, and that Randy is a known drug dealer. A witness is brought forth, Tracy Bartlett, who testifies he bought $1,800 worth of cocaine from Randy and Kenny just days before the murders. If Randy and Kenny were involved in the drug game, they may have had to pay back their suppliers at the end of what would have been a busy July 4th. Since Kenny was supposedly involved in the racket, we know he couldn't have made the meeting because a witness saw him at the factory that night.
I seen Kenny Kunz's car.
Is that a automobile you're familiar with?
Yeah.
And did you see Mr. Kunz as well?
Yes, I did.
And where was he when you saw him?
Entering the building.
While Randy waits for Kenny to show up with the rest of the money, his suppliers are getting impatient. The suppliers go into the house to wait for Kenny. They run into Marie. She is the first to die. Kenny is nowhere to be seen. They get desperate. Randy is sure his brother has just lost track of the time and will be there in a moment with the money. But is it possible that Kenny was wholly forgotten? The defense posits that it's not until it's too late that Kenny remembers he was supposed to meet Randy and give him the money. The suppliers aren't having any of Randy's delay tactics. They must have some cash here. They're going to get theirs one way or another. Kenny heads home but is terrified to face his brother without the money. He decides to avoid the house altogether rather than face the music. But Randy has to play a tune of his own when his family is threatened. Unfortunately, the Kunzes are in a fight for their lives. A fight they can't win. But why did they take Helen to another location to dump her body? Only the perpetrators of this brutal crime know the answer. And the man in custody maintains his innocence. The defense's theories are put to the test, and many are crumbling. Their witness to Randy's drug dealing is lying. He was in jail when the alleged transactions took place. But there is still a question of where all of the cash in the Kunz house came from. Surely there is more evidence to show some kind of drug involvement, but there isn't.
We didn't find any drug paraphernalia. Scales, needles, drugs themselves, no marijuana, cocaine, packaging material, nothing like that.
The trial was on circumstantial evidence, certainly, but it was pretty heavy circumstantial evidence, in my opinion. To say that he absolutely pulled the trigger, I don't know that anybody can say that.
The prosecutors are confident that they've made their case. The defense hopes that they're able to show that Chris is innocent, as Chris Jacobs III's mother testifies he was helping her birth a calf at 11 p.m. that night.
Yes, down number 5, not guilty of murder in the first degree. Yes.
Chris Jacobs III is found not guilty.
So at the end of this trial, the jury concludes that Chris Jacobs is not guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and really that's due to a lack of hard evidence tying him directly to the offense. In this situation, the evidence that's presented to the jury is largely circumstantial in nature, and unfortunately the jury does not find that compelling enough to render a conviction.
To me, I was very surprised.
I was shocked at the verdict. It made no sense to me. And I remember typing out the story that my hands were actually trembling as I was typing the story because it was just so disturbing. I felt like this family had been slaughtered, and because of their strangeness, the jury decided to give this kid the benefit of the doubt. We don't know what happened. And really, are we going to send a kid to jail for the rest of his life? Let's give him the benefit of the doubt.
Authorities have run out of options. They're confident that the evidence points towards Chris Jacobs III, but the jury doesn't agree with them. They'll have to go back to the evidence to see if they can find a break in the case. 2 years pass with nothing new, until a chance arrest and a story give police a startling clue. It's 1993. Chris Jacobs has been working construction since he was acquitted of the Kunz family murders. However, one day before the statute of limitations runs out, Chris Jacobs is arrested again.
I remember the conversation among myself and a number of my colleagues. None of us are attorneys. We're asking ourselves, can they do this? Because it sounds like double jeopardy.
Double jeopardy is a clause in the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution that prohibits anyone from being tried twice for the same crime. It states that no person shall be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb.
Prosecutors maintain that Chris Jacobs is not being charged twice for the same crime. In 1989, he was charged with being party to murder and acquitted. This time, he's being accused for the kidnapping of Helen Coons. With their new witness, Chris's ex-girlfriend Stacy Weiss, all ears are open to hear what new evidence she'll present.
Chris Jacobs' girlfriend, his girlfriend at that time, told police that they were driving back from something, a bowling league. And Chris said to her, if I told you I killed the Kuntz family, what would you think? And drove her to the Kuntz house and showed her the garden and showed her the house, drove her to the marsh, showed her where the body had been found, and told her that he had killed them. And killed Helen there. Her statement became he raped her in order to prove his manhood, to prove that he was a man.
From there, the story is hazy. Helen is subsequently killed and her body thrown into the swamp. The defense retort that Stacy is Chris's ex-girlfriend who has an axe to grind after they have a falling out, saying that Stacy has recently been arrested for a robbery and making up these accusations for the DA to drop the charges. But Stacy Weiss's testimony isn't the only evidence the prosecutors have. Authorities have a receipt for the tires that Chris bought after being to the Coonses, along with the evidence from the first trial about the tires. They also have the bullet casings found at Chris's house and the Coonses on top of the spotlight found in Chris's possession. This, coupled with Chris's threats to a prosecutor witness Wayne D. Weiler after the first trial, is enough for the jury. Chris Jacobs is convicted for the kidnapping of Helen Coons and sentenced to 31 years in jail on July 7th, 1993. Despite multiple appeals, the conviction is upheld. While many believe that justice was served with Chris's conviction, some believe that he is innocent and that he is just another victim of the murders in Marathon County on July 4th, 1987. Whatever happened on those back roads, we may never know. We know that Helen Coons and four other members of the Coons family ended up dead. The Coons family massacre remains an open case because the only person ever charged with their deaths was acquitted. There has never been any other serious suspects in the case. The facts confound authorities and researchers alike. Who killed the Coons family?
You know, one of the things that sticks with me and has from the very beginning is these people may have lived a different sort of lifestyle, but what happened to them was terrible. They didn't do anything to deserve this.